It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and we're going to learn from a pair of restaurant owners and master composters how to cut our own food waste down to zero, and we'll enjoy some new recipes while doing it. First, new research shows that MDMA, also known as ecstasy or Molly, has a lot of potential to help heal severe cases of things like post-traumatic stress disorder. MDMA has been a popular party drug and a Schedule I controlled substance, the most restrictive level of drug control in the U.S. It has a history full of twists and turns, stretching back to 1912 and featuring use by therapists, ravers, and government agents trying to discover a truth serum during the Cold War. As with some other psychedelic drugs, scientists are discovering that MDMA has the potential to help address not just PTSD, but depression, addiction, existential anxiety faced by terminal patients, and more. In a new book, our next guest traces the past, present, and future of MDMA as a therapy and in recreational use. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you used MDMA, and are you willing to share that story? What was your experience like with it? What do you want to know about how the drug works, its safety, or its potential to help PTSD and other mental health problems? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Rachel Neuer is a journalist and author. Her new book is I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
A lot of fascinating stories in your book. What led you, Rachel, to dig into this history of MDMA?
Oh, man, I just felt like the time was really ripe for MDMA to get its own story. You know, Michael Pollan really covered LSD and psilocybin in his book, How to Change Your Mind, a few years ago. But MDMA is a molecule with just as rich a history and a story in terms of politics, culture, science, and mental health.
Take us back to the invention of this drug in 1912, I think you write. And then it seems like people didn't really know what to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, the story really begins on Christmas Eve 1912, when the German pharmaceutical company Merck filed a patent for MDMA, but they weren't actually looking for MDMA. It was just a chemical intermediary on a series of steps they were taking to get to a blood clotting agent. Merck denies that they ever realized that MDMA actually had psychoactive properties. That denial is a little questionable. But yeah, it popped up again in the 1950s during the U.S.'s search for a chemical truth serum, really unethical period in U.S. history when the CIA and the Army were doing tests on American citizens and Army soldiers. We don't actually know if MDMA was ever given to anybody. We haven't found that sort of smoking gun document to prove that the Army did give pay people MDMA. What we do know, though, is that it reemerged in 1975 in the Bay Area when a chemist resynthesized it and introduced it to the therapeutic community.
Before we dig more into the history, I want to talk a little bit about what the drug MDMA does. And a weird thing is, it depends. It seems like the experience might be very different if I'm sitting down for a therapy session with talk therapists and taking this versus I'm on a dance floor with 120 beats per minute electronic music going. Why is it so? What do we know about why it's so context dependent?
Yeah, well, like most or all, in fact, psychedelic drugs, it's really about the set and the setting. So that refers to your mindset, what you're going into the experience, your mental baggage, your expectations, and the actual physical setting. So I have never done MDMA in a therapeutic context, but, you know, I've heard people who have say, you know, I don't know why they call this ecstasy. This is not an ecstatic experience. This is really difficult, hard, profound work. Whereas if you're just going in to have some light fun and dance all night with your friends, you're going to have a completely different experience. It is going to be euphoric. You're going to feel a deep sense of connection on the dance floor. You're probably going to have a really good time.
And your book shares a title with the great Donna Summer groundbreaking song, I Feel Love. And that is apparently a common, not a universal, but a common part of an experience using this drug.
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, without knowing the title of my book, quite a few of my interview subjects use that exact phrase that, oh, you know, I felt love on this drug, or I even felt love for myself or for others for the first time in my entire life, in the case of some highly traumatized people.
Talking to Rachel Neuer about her new book. It's called I Feel Love, MDMA, and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rachel, you write that there was a period where we had people experimenting with MDMA as a therapy. Then it becomes outlawed effectively in 1985. Can you talk about that process that made it a Schedule I drug?
Yes. So therapists were introduced to MDMA quietly beginning in 1975, 1976, and it spread from the Bay Area out across the US and even to Europe. And they found that this was a really phenomenal tool that they could apply to pretty much any form of psychotherapy, whether it was couples therapy, helping people to process their trauma, or just helping people get more deeply in touch with themselves. But they knew that they needed to keep quiet about this new drug because they had seen what had happened to LSD a few years before. LSD in the 50s was given to some 40,000 patients around the world as a therapeutic aid, but then it was politicized, it was criminalized, it was outlawed. And they knew that if the US federal government caught wind of this new drug, the same fate would befall it. Well, lo and behold, that is what happened. The DEA caught wind of MDMA. They moved to schedule it, to put it on Schedule I, which is the most strictly banned substances with no current medical value, a high potential for abuse. The therapeutic community actually fought back against this. They put together a case, and they took the DEA to court. This was therapists, doctors, even Harvard professors arguing to the DEA that MDMA should in fact be a Schedule III drug, which would permit its use in medical context and also allow research to continue. They actually won that case. The administrative law judge sided with them and said, yes, MDMA should be Schedule III. But because it was an administrative case, the DEA only took that judgment as an opinion. And they just did, I guess, what they had planned to do all along, which was put MDMA on Schedule I, where it has remained ever since.
Things have loosened up some, you write, more people are able to do research. And I want to get into what seems to be the most advanced, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. What are therapists doing with MDMA for people with PTSD?
Yes. So this has been about a 20-year effort to test MDMA-assisted therapy's effectiveness for PTSD. You know, it's just taken that long because of bureaucracy and also because researchers cannot easily get federal funding to test Schedule I substances. So that's why it's taken so long. But the results so far are really promising. The most recent phase 3 clinical trial, and this is 2 out of 3 necessary phase 3 trials before the drug can gain FDA approval. The results were very, very promising. About 2/3 of the 100 or so participants emerged after just 3 sessions of MDMA assisted therapy with no longer qualifying for a PTSD diagnosis. And these are people with severe cases of PTSD, with histories of suicidal ideation, with substance abuse disorders. They had had PTSD for something like, you know, 16 years on average. So these are really, really promising results that sort of blow out of the water any results we've seen from just talk therapy alone or traditional pharmaceuticals.
A lot of your book deals with the stories of people who have used MDMA for treatment. Can you share a little bit about the people you met who had been through PTSD treatment involving MDMA?
Oh, gosh, there were so many stories. And, you know, many of them were really emotional for me to hear. You know, I heard from a veteran who had served in Vietnam and come back with really severe PTSD that he didn't recognize himself. And he lived with this crippling condition literally for decades until his wife was basically gave him an ultimatum and said, you have to get help for this or I can't stay with you. And after he did MDMA assisted therapy, he was finally able to recognize that deep, deep wound he had suffered as a result of what happened to him in Vietnam and begin to connect with himself, to forgive himself, and even to connect with his wife. He said that was the most beautiful thing that he got out of this. Now he's not afraid to talk to her and be honest with her about his feelings.
And I want to spell this out a little. This isn't, I get a prescription for an MDMA pill, I go home and I take it once a day or once a month or whatever. Can you talk through the process that people went through in this therapy?
Yeah, absolutely. That is such an important point. This isn't, here's your MDMA, go home and take it. And this also isn't, okay, well, we're going to meet here, you know, every week and take MDMA for the rest of your life. It's not a one and done process, but it's a lot closer to that model than something like traditional SSRIs or talk therapy would be. So you have a few sessions where you meet with a therapist, you talk about your issues, you talk about what you're hoping to get out of the actual medication session. Then on the day of, you meet with two therapists, ideally a man and a woman, and you put on blindfold, like a eye shades, you put on headphones, you take the pill, you lie back on a couch or a bed, and you wait for the drug to take effect. Some people, once it does take effect, get really chatty. You know, they want to talk to their therapist. They want to process things out loud. Some people go deep into inside themselves and barely say a word the entire time. The whole thing takes about 7 or 8 hours. It's an entire day. For the clinical trials, at least, it was 3 sessions spaced a month apart. But in terms of the ideal number of sessions, that's something scientists and therapists are going to have to work out once this treatment is approved. You know, for some people, it could be fewer. For some people, it could be more.
We're talking to journalist and author Rachel Neuer about her new book. It's called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you or a loved one have experienced PTSD, would you be willing to try this MDMA-assisted therapy? Have you sought it out yourself? Do you think MDMA should be legalized for medicinal use, for recreational use? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with journalist and author Rachel Neuer. Her new book is called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for a Connection in a Fractured World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the latest research on the use of MDMA? That's often called ecstasy or Molly more recently, and other psychedelics to help with things like PTSD and other mental health conditions. Do you have experience with this particular drug yourself that you're willing to tell us about? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel, I want to talk about why this particular drug might help in this particular way. And some of the research is looking at the idea of a critical period in our brains. Talk us through that.
Yeah. So researchers have wondered for years why it is that something that is so short acting like MDMA can have such profound lasting effects. And new neuroscience coming out of the lab of Gul Dolin at Johns Hopkins seems to perhaps provide an answer to that question. So under the set and setting of therapy, so when you go in prime to interact with your trauma and with a therapist's guidance, the brain seems to reopen what neuroscientists call a critical period. Critical periods are finite periods of malleability, usually that occur in childhood, when the brain is primed to learn new things, to make new connections, to set us up with the habits that will give us a lifetime of success out here in the world. It's why, for example, children can learn a new language so much easier than we adults can. What MDMA seems to do under that therapeutic guidance is reopen a social reward learning critical period. And this allows people to really reevaluate and reassess their trauma, the stories they've told themselves about their trauma, about themselves, the habits they formed around that trauma. If you think about typical PTSD symptoms. So you're literally rewiring your brain when you do MDMA-assisted therapy, which is what makes it so powerful if these results are indeed accurate.
What is the frontier of research on this now, trying to connect the dots between using something like MDMA in a therapy session and making these changes?
Yeah, I mean, there's very interesting research on the horizon. There's already been studies on using MDMA for severe social anxiety in autistic adults. There are studies going on in the UK now for MDMA's use for treating alcohol addiction. What I think is really interesting is if these critical period results hold up, then MDMA and actually other psychedelic drugs could be so-called master keys for reopening critical periods. And what that means is if you tune the set and setting, if instead of doing talk therapy, for example, you do occupational therapy, you could reopen a different critical period for motor learning. So at Johns Hopkins, they're now pursuing the idea of giving stroke patients MDMA and then giving them occupational therapy to see if they can regain much, much greater mobility than they would without the drug.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us in Milwaukee. Aaron, hi.
Hi, how's it going today?
Good. What did you want to share with us?
Okay, so I was in the military from the periods of 2001 to 2008, and I did 2 tours of combat while I was in, and stress has really taken a toll just kind of like on my mental health. And I've tried different therapies as far as, you know, talk therapy, and I couldn't connect with the people enough to feel comfortable enough sharing everything that I've been through. I have just recently been exposed to microdosing with psilocybin, but I haven't started yet or tried it. But how can somebody that, like myself, whose profession really hinders their ability to seek all therapies, try something different that might work?
Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for sharing that. And I'm sorry you're dealing with this and haven't found a solution, at least not yet. But Rachel, Aaron's story sounds like a lot of the people you talk to in the book. And something he mentioned, he has a hard time being able to fully open up about his experiences in a talk therapy session. That's something you heard, I think, actually from veterans in your research.
Absolutely. Yeah, Aaron, thank you so much for sharing that story. And just know that you absolutely are not alone in these feelings. One of the beautiful things about MDMA-assisted therapy is the drug lowers activity in the amygdala, which is the brain's fear center. So people don't feel just our natural reaction to keep things to ourselves, to protect ourselves, to present a certain image of ourselves to the world. We're better able to just be ourselves and be open. MDMA also increases feelings of connection with other people, which really helps in terms of the therapeutic process and kind of speeding the process of building trust with your therapists. As far as accessing MDMA under the context of your current job, unfortunately, it is still currently illegal. So you're going to have to wait if you want to do it legally until the FDA approves it. But hopefully that will happen by this time next year. And I should add too that there are now trials going on at VAs around the country. I have not heard of any in Wisconsin, but you can look those up. There's one in the Bronx. There's one in Oregon, in Texas.
Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. We are talking to Rachel Neuer about her new book, I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. Back to your calls now. Ruth Ann is with us in Madison. Ruth Ann, hi.
Hi. Yeah, my question, actually I have 2 of them, but I know that people experience PTSD for a variety of reasons, whether you're in the war, you could experience it from a bad car accident, also, you know, like from childhood traumas of every kind. So is there a type of PTSD that this works better for? I've not read your book, and maybe it's answered in there, but I'd like to read your book. I was also curious about how young or what's the ages that this can be used for other than adults, if so. So those are my questions.
Ruth Ann, thanks for the call. Rachel, you did talk to people who experienced different causes of PTSD. Your thoughts for Ruth Ann?
Yeah, both excellent questions. So the clinical trials involved not just veterans, but people with all forms of PTSD from childhood, from sexual assault, first responders, from natural disasters, things like that. And the results held up across the board. This seems to be an effective treatment regardless of the source of your PTSD. So that's great news. In terms of, what was the second part of that question?
How young can people be in trials for?
So these trials were for adults, but actually the FDA, if they approve MDMA-assisted therapy, there is a requirement that adolescents then have to go through clinical trials as well. So this could wind up being a treatment that can be given to adolescents as well, but we're going to have to await those safety and efficacy results.
Ruth Ann, thanks for the call. Rachel, I should ask, people might be listening thinking, hey, this is a Schedule One controlled substance. Aren't there risks? Are there harms? What do we know?
Yeah, definitely. MDMA, like anything, you know, like water, like aspirin, can be unsafe and even deadly if you take too much of it or you take it under the wrong circumstances. In a therapist's office, there have been no serious side effects or emergencies or anything like that. However, if you do take it out in the world illegally, you run the risk of taking tainted drugs because, again, you're having to buy the drug illegally. You don't know what you're getting unless you test it yourself. You also run the risk of accidentally taking too much MDMA and overdosing yourself if you're not testing the drugs for the percentage content and then weighing out an appropriate sample. The two things that tend to occur most often in terms of emergencies and even deaths from MDMA are overheating. So you're dancing all night, you're not drinking water, you're not taking breaks, and you perhaps took too much MDMA. And also some people wind up drinking too much water, and MDMA causes the body to retain water. So if you start chugging gallons of water, you can cause something called the name escapes me, but it lowers your sodium levels in your blood, which can cause your brain cells to swell, and that can be deadly. So hyponatremia, that is the name.
Rachel, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your book with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Rachel Neuer, journalist and author. She talked to us about her new book. It's called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll talk to the co-authors of the new cookbook, Perfectly Good Food, a totally achievable approach to zero waste cooking. If you have a way to cut back on food waste that is working for you, we want to hear about it. You can post right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get a reaction to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision this week to end race-based affirmative action for admissions on college campuses, and you can share your thoughts. Now it's Food Friday. We're going to get some recipes, like usual, and cooking advice, plus a way for cooks to help with climate change. 2 weeks ago, UW-Madison climate researcher Dan Vimont was on the show. He shared some ways for people to help fight climate change. He mentioned a climate solutions nonprofit called Project Drawdown, and according to them, reducing food waste is the most impactful solution toward addressing climate change. Well, if you spend any time in a kitchen, you're probably pretty well acquainted with food waste. Our next guests are chefs and sisters who have tackled this issue head on. They've got lots of advice and recipes for us to reduce waste ourselves down to zero if we want to go for that and make some great food along the way. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you run into this pretty often in your own fridge, say? You end up having to throw away a lot more than you want to? What does it look like in your kitchen? Do you overbuy herbs or greens or whatever? Do you have some advice you follow to reduce food waste? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Irene Lee is a 2022 James Beard Leadership Award winner and lives in Boston supporting the May May Dumplings team. And May Lee is the founder of Food Waste Feast, an online project to help home cooks quit wasting food, and lives in Glasgow, Scotland. They're co-authors of the cookbook Double Awesome Chinese Food. Their newest cookbook is called Perfectly Good Food, a totally achievable zero-waste approach to home cooking. Irene and May, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having us.
We're very excited to be here. Thank you.
Irene, let's start with you. You both actually have a lot of experience in the restaurant business. Can you talk about your experience there? I assume just for pure reasons of the bottom line, you got to watch out for food waste, right?
That's right. You know, when you cook in a professional kitchen, it's your job to not waste food. The ingredients are your raw materials, and so that's your money going in the trash. But you know, at home, most of us have other full-time jobs. And so saving our food, making sure it doesn't end up getting wasted, that can kind of fall by the wayside.
And May, why have you taken on reducing food waste as close to zero as possible?
So when I wrote our first cookbook, I kind of realized how a lot of recipes make it difficult for home cooks to use up what they have. They might ask you to go out and buy some new ingredients, and you might pick up something like you need a tablespoon of parsley. So you head out and you buy a whole bunch, and then you don't know what to do with that parsley. You've got a bunch minus one tablespoon of parsley. So how do you use up the rest of those things? I wanted to figure out a way for home cooks to be as efficient as possible and stop putting so much food waste in the landfill. As it sounds like your previous guest mentioned, food waste in the landfill creates methane, which is a really potent greenhouse gas, and it's really bad for the environment. And also all of that, the raw materials and the natural resources that go into producing that food, all that gets wasted when your food goes into the trash.
All right, one of the ideas in the book, I don't know who gets credit for this one. I can't believe I never thought of this. The Eat Me First box. Where did that come from?
That's definitely an Irene one. I'll let her take that.
Sure. So when we first got into our restaurant and we had a walk-in refrigerator, we knew that we had to do an even better job keeping track of all of our ingredients. In a walk-in, stuff can get lost really easily. So we decided to designate an Eat Me First box. You could also call that Use First if you were in a restaurant. And that's where we put anything that is high priority to get rid of or use up. So it might be something that's nearing its best by date. It might be like half a tomato or a slice of lemon, sort of the odds and ends that if you don't pay attention to them, they might get lost and end up getting wasted. So we love implementing that at home. I definitely have had moments where there are several moldy half lemons in the back corners of my refrigerator. So if we can do a better job keeping track of what needs to go, what needs to be prioritized, keeping that box at eye level, making sure it's labeled, don't let that migrate to the back of the fridge, that can help a lot.
And May, one key to the book, when we're talking about produce, our fruits and vegetables, is, okay, this doesn't look so beautiful that I just want to eat this raw right out of the fridge, but that doesn't mean it's dead yet, right? Could you talk about trying to find ways for that in between produce?
That is totally true. So there might be a fruit that's not perfect to eat raw, but you could make that into jam, or you could cook it into a cake, or you could blend it into a smoothie. And the same goes for vegetables. You know, you might have this tomato that is not going to be the most delicious BLT, but it will make a perfectly good tomato sauce, or could become gazpacho. Again, blending is really useful if the texture isn't perfect. And so there's so many ways to make sure that your produce that you spent good money on is getting eaten, even if it's not, you know, perfect salad quality. If you're going to cook it and kind of change up the texture, then you can have really delicious meals with that stuff that just doesn't look good.
We're talking to May Lee and Irene Lee about their new book. It's called Perfectly Good Food, a totally achievable zero-waste approach to home cooking. You can join this Food Friday conversation. Have you found ways to cut back on food waste? Or is there something that always gets you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Irene, a big part of the book is hero recipes, these recipes that are flexible, and they can work in a bunch of our different kinds of food that will otherwise go to waste. Can you talk about the philosophy behind these hero recipes?
Yeah, we like to call them hero recipes. I call them superhero recipes because they help you rescue food, all your odds and ends that you might not have a home for. They're basically templates. So it might be a stir fry or a cream of anything soup. And if you understand generally how the recipe works, you can modify it to accommodate any number of ingredients. So maybe you had a delicious cheese and charcuterie board last night, and now you have half an ounce of five different cheeses. How are you going to use those? Well, you could look at a frittata or a soup or a fondue. These ideas are all about helping the home cook practice being flexible and just trying out whatever they happen to have on hand. And we always like to say, if the recipe doesn't come out so great, you just eat the evidence and you move on.
And we've got a few of these recipes at WPR.org/Central Time, these hero recipes. May, let's check one of them out. The How You Like It Savory Pancakes. Tell us a little bit about the recipe and how we can work some different ingredients on the way out into our cooking.
Yes, so this is one of my favorite recipes. It is based on the Japanese dish called okonomiyaki. And it's really interesting because it is actually kind of meant to be how you like it. And they are made in tons of different ways. You could have these savory pancakes with pork belly and squid, I believe is traditional, but you could also have it. I saw it once in a restaurant with a Thanksgiving special with turkey and cranberry sauce. So you can kind of put in whatever you can find in your fridge. You just use a similar base of cabbage, eggs, flour, and you're kind of making these delicious savory pancakes, but then you can toss in whatever you like. And it's so flexible and it makes it really easy to have this basic template that you make the same way every time, but a little part of it, you just switch it up based on what you need to use up.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Nancy is with us in Lac de Flambeau. Nancy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Nancy?
Oh, thank you. Hey, ladies, I love your book, and I struggle with this because I don't like waste. And, I mean, I worked at Greenpeace for years and stuff like that. But what I'm trying to do now is to convince my neighbors to give me their waste because I have a dear good friend who runs her own farm, and apparently chickens eat food waste all the time. I had no idea. And so if you have any advice about how do I make it into a community thing? Or maybe add that to your book, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, what do you think of the idea of feeding the chicken?
Interesting, Nancy. That's a great use for the food. And I know, Irene, I believe both of you are big composters as well. Can you talk about other ways? Even if we humans don't end up eating the food, animals or microbes might.
Yeah, so thanks so much for the call, Nancy. We like to think about food waste reduction as kind of a pyramid. Ideally, we would be able to feed food that might get wasted to humans. If not to humans, then to animals, chickens like you do, that's awesome. And if not to animals, then at least we can compost it and retain some of the nutrients in the life cycle. We've also heard from folks while on our book tour that they and their friends might actually have like food waste or food rescue potlucks. So everybody takes some leftovers and repurposes them, and it's kind of a fun little theme for a meal. So I think there are lots of fun ways to get other folks involved in this effort. And, you know, at the end of your potluck, anything that doesn't get eaten, that can go into a bin for the chickens.
I think I'd rather go to a food rescue potluck than a food waste potluck. That sounds less
appetizing. You don't want to eat trash?
Nancy, thanks a lot for that call. Michael is with us now in Neenah. Michael, hi.
Hi. So I love the show. And I just wanted to say, as we're growing older, my wife and I are now alone. And it's hard for us to eat a whole package of like blueberries and strawberries. And they're such good deals right now. So what we do is, or what I do is I watch, and as they're starting to wilt a little bit, I'll cook them down into a compote. We had crepes this morning, blueberry crepes with topped with strawberries. It was really good.
That sounds fantastic, Michael. I'm right there with you, man. You know, going from having two teenagers in the house to having zero teenagers in the house makes me have to adapt what I buy and what I do with it. May, what do you think of Michael's? It sounds like he comes into that berry buying with that plan in place. Like, we're going to eat some, we're going to compote some. You know, you could freeze some too. That kind of planning when we get the stuff in the first place.
Absolutely. That is so smart. Thank you for calling. And I love that idea. And, you know, fresh compote that you've made yourself is so delicious and you can kind of tailor it to your own tastes. I have two small children. And so I'm always saving little bits of fruit, especially when they decide they want one slice of apple and then they don't want the rest of it. And so I put all those little extra bits of fruit into a bag in my freezer. It's called the smoothie bag. And then when they want a smoothie, I will just pop all those little bits of frozen fruit into the blender, blend it up with whatever kind of juice I have or yogurt or ice cream, and then they drink it as a smoothie. And I have also been known to, when they don't finish their smoothie, I will pour the smoothie into a popsicle mold and then feed it to them as a popsicle. So I am making sure that they are eating that expensive fruit that I've bought for them.
Michael, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Irene and May Lee about their latest cookbook on Food Friday. The book is called Perfectly Good Food, a totally achievable zero-waste approach to home cooking. I had a plan when my kids were little and they didn't finish their food. It was called Dad Finishes Their Food. It had some non-sustainable long-term consequences. I'll say that. Hey, you could join in with your thoughts on food waste at 800-642-1234. Is there something you always have trouble finishing up? You need some inspiration, or have you found solutions you want to share? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with sisters and co-authors Irene and May Lee about their new cookbook. It's called Perfectly Good Food, a totally achievable zero-waste approach to home cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234 and find a couple recipes from our guests at WPR.org/Central Time. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Amy is with us in Weston. Amy, hi.
Hi, I love this topic. I just want to say that that's how I sort of do my shopping list now. I'll go into the Pick and Save, the Kroger. I'll go into the produce area where they bundle up things for 99 cents. And I'm like, okay, I guess I'm going to make baba ganoush with two eggplants for 99 cents. It's such a good deal. Otherwise, I know that would go in the trash. There's never a brown banana that goes in the trash here. It goes in the freezer. It can become part of a smoothie. There's just so many creative things that you can do without it going into the trash can.
Amy, thanks a lot for sharing both of those ideas. Irene, first of all, her idea, she looks for that produce that's going bad. They're selling off cheap and comes up with a plan based on that. What do you think of that philosophy?
I love that. It sounds like Amy's a real pro. And part of what we want to do with the book is encourage people to experiment, to be empowered to try out something that maybe they've never tried before, if they're inspired by what they see at the farmer's market or the grocery store. And the good news is that it also can be really budget friendly. So if you're able to buy seconds or B grade, you can make your dollar go a lot further.
Thanks for that call, Amy. And May, she also mentioned those bananas. Now, she'll freeze those bananas going off and use them as smoothies or in smoothies, which I also do. Also, coincidentally, one of the recipes you shared with us is the accidental best banana bread. Can you talk about your banana bread?
Yes, I really love this recipe, which is funny because it came out of a total kitchen accident. I was buying bananas at the supermarket and they came in one of those bags. I don't know if they're available everywhere, but it was a bag that had banana recipes printed all over it. And so I figured, hey, I'll try this banana recipe. And I was sort of haphazardly multitasking in the kitchen like I often do. And I left out an entire cup of white flour, which was like half the flour in the recipe. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be the best banana bread I've ever had. And I think it's, you know, it really brings out the banana flavor. It's not as bready. It's more like this kind of gooey banana cake. And I think it's fantastic. And it came out of a total accident. So, you know, back to the experimenting in the kitchen is sometimes not following a recipe perfectly can lead to some fun new surprises.
Thanks again for that call. We're talking to Irene and May Lee about their new book, Perfectly Good Food, a totally achievable zero-waste approach to home cooking. Still time for you to share your questions or food waste solutions at 800-642-1234. Find that accidental banana bread recipe online at WPR.org/Central Time. Irene, let's talk about expiration dates. We're a big dairy state here in Wisconsin. How by the book are we on those dates?
Well, expiration dates, as it turns out, are really just the manufacturer's idea of when a product is going to be at its best or at its freshest. And so they don't necessarily have anything to do with food safety. It's the manufacturer's way of encouraging you to use it up when it will be at its peak. So we really encourage eaters and cooks to use their senses when it comes to evaluating whether food is safe to eat. How does it smell? How does it feel? Is it slimy? Is it stinky? And, you know, even food that has technically perhaps soured or started to ferment in some cases can be safe to eat. Of course, if you're feeding kiddos or someone elderly or immunocompromised, you might want to be a little bit more careful. But the manufacturers really, they want you to enjoy the food as fast as possible and go out and buy more. So we want to say, take those dates with a big grain of salt.
And May, can you talk about using that freezer as our caller did with her bananas? Any advice on what to freeze, how to freeze it?
Yes. So we love the freezer because we basically think of it as this magical time-stopping tool on your food. You can save food almost indefinitely with the freezer, but the quality will sort of start to degrade the longer it is in the freezer. So one big recommendation is to minimize as much air as possible in your freezer goods. So the air is what causes the freezer burn. And so if you can press out all the air from a bag or make sure to fill up to the top, liquids are an exception there. You want to leave some space at the top for them to expand. And the idea is that the freezer will just hold stuff indefinitely. And as long as your freezer hasn't lost power or something, it'll hold on to your food. We know that it's sometimes easy to forget about something in the freezer. So we always encourage labeling and dating. So we personally like permanent markers and painter's tape. You can put it on your containers and say, you know, this is the beef soup I made in March. And then you don't mix it up for something like spiced apple cider 6 months later.
Irene, over the years here on Food Friday, I've gotten some like, green onions or scallions. You don't just use the white part. You can use the green part. Or Lydia Bastianich has me freezing my pasta water sometimes because you can use that in stocks and other things. Are there other examples where, hey, this is the thing you might not even have thought of as food, but you can actually do food stuff with it?
That's a great question. One of my favorite recipes in the book is our scrap chili oil. And so that really utilizes things that have a lot of flavor, but might not have the best texture. So think garlic peels or like the little butt ends of your garlic cloves, papery onion skins, ginger peels. These things are full of flavor. And when you pour hot oil over them, you get this incredibly aromatic, delicious, savory sauce that you can then drizzle on whatever you want.
And May, speaking of those bits that we don't always use, soup is my magic go-to. If it's edible, you know, something you'd want to eat, it ends up in my soup. I often call it fridge soup. And if you don't really want to eat it, like the stuff Irene was just talking about, I'll use it for making soup stock. Any thoughts on using soup as our magical cure-all for food waste?
100%. I'm with you. We have a recipe called cream of anything soup because we believe the same thing. You know, you can have this vegetable with lots of flavor, but maybe not the best texture, or you don't really know what else to do with it. You can toss it into a soup and you can make it delicious. And we're also all about making things into condiments. And then you can use your delicious condiments to drizzle on top of your soup. And then it feels fancy and new and adds extra to different textures. So yes, we're all about it.
Time for one more call. Laura is with us in Madison. Laura, hi.
Hi, Rob.
What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I have a couple ideas that are good for cutting down on food waste. And the first one I know you're familiar with because you've had shows like this before, but cook once and eat two or three times. And then my second idea is, so when I make a meal and I have leftovers, I portion everything out right away after the meal for lunch-sized portions, and I put them in glass or clear plastic in the refrigerator, so that my kids aren't standing in front of the refrigerator wondering what's in there because they can see it.
Laura, thanks a lot for those ideas. The planning there, Irene, is the key, I think. Like, she knows she's making it for this meal and the next meal or for signal servings for her kids. Leave us with some thoughts on that kind of meal planning to help avoid food waste.
Yeah, I love that approach. And I think another really important thing is glass or clear plastic. When things are out of sight, they end up out of mind. And that's how I think a lot of food ends up getting forgotten about in the fridge.
Laura, thanks for that call. And Irene and May, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
May and Irene Lee are co-authors of the new cookbook we've been talking about. It's called Perfectly Good Food, a totally achievable, zero-waste approach to home cooking. You can keep sharing your ideas on how to beat food waste, avoid food waste online. Go to the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. And then check out a few recipes, hero recipes from Irene and May. You can find those at WPR.org/Central Time. Starting tomorrow, listeners to Wisconsin Public Radio at 90.9 FM in the Madison area, you're going to want to reset your radio to 90.5 FM to hear the Ideas Network. 90.9 is going to stop broadcasting and be replaced by a more powerful signal at 90.5 FM. It's going to be the same stuff on the air, but it's going to serve a larger area for listeners in the South Central Wisconsin area. Thanks for making that switch. Again, that's coming up tomorrow. Find more details and find out how to listen to us wherever you go in the state. You can find that out over at WPR.org/signal. That's WPR.org/signal. You may be getting ready to celebrate the 4th of July, but you can get started with another holiday right now because today is Asteroid Day. Why? As reported at space.com, the United Nations declared June 30th as Asteroid Day, following the lead of a number of scientists, astronauts, and others, including Brian May, guitarist for Queen, who's an astrophysicist. The day marks the anniversary of the Tunguska asteroid event in Siberia in 1908. How are we supposed to celebrate Asteroid Day? There's a lot of local events around the world, none in Wisconsin that I can see, but there's lots of online lectures and live streams. Find them at space.com and learn more about asteroids. Celebrate at home? I don't know, maybe play the old video game Asteroids. I'm going to have to check on the scientific accuracy of that. You could make some meatballs in the shape of asteroids or just sit around and contemplate the existence of asteroids. The sky's the limit. Actually, no, asteroids are further away than the sky. Space news you can use. This is Central Time.